The BBC Concert Orchestra leader Charles Mutter and conductor Keith Lockhart with Rob Mathis's arrangement of four songs by the Beatles, and we ended, of course, there with Long and Winding Road. About to join me now is a man who himself has taken many long and winding journeys in the course of his career as a naturalist and a broadcaster, and taken time out on an imaginary desert island no fewer than four times. Only Arthur Askey came onto the desert island as many times as that. He is the great Sir David Attenborough.
Good evening. A pleasure to see you. How are you?
Thank you very much.
So welcome. I should remind people you were Roy Plumley's guest twice. That was, I've got it down here, 1957,
yes.
1979. Then you chatted to Sue Lawley in 1998, and I was lucky enough to have you on the programme in January of this year as our very special 70th anniversary guest.
It was. Thank you.
I could say that we're almost finding you in your natural habitat this evening because
yeah.
you really do like the proms. I mean, you're a regular.
Yeah, yes, I've been coming to the proms certainly for 60 years. I used to live down the road. Right. I have prommed. I've never done the stalwart things that some people here do to go to every single one, but I've been to quite a lot, and I come, yes, pretty regularly.
And so four Desert Island Discs appearances. Did your music change? How did your music change throughout the decades?
Well, that's a consequence of coming to the proms, actually. You hear the marvellous thing about the proms is the great mixture, isn't it? I mean, I came a few nights ago to listen to Brahms and found myself listening to a piece I'd never heard before called by Luther Slavsky, and it was electrifying. It was marvellous, and that's what the proms does, which is a thrill.
Well, it was a thrill for me to have you as our esteemed 70th birthday guest. Thank you so much for coming along tonight, and we hope you're going to enjoy, indeed I know you are going to enjoy, this next piece of music. So David Attenborough, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
So, Sir David and many other castaways have chosen music by Handel, and we have some of that to take us up to the interval tonight. The Huddersfield Choral Society joined the concert orchestra in two excerpts from Handel's Oratorio Messiah and The Glory of the Lord, followed by the magnificently uplifting Hallelujah Chorus.
Glory, the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. two excerpts from Handel's Messiah and the Glory of the Lord, and bringing the first half of this Desert Island Discs prom to a rousing finish, the Hallelujah Chorus, also bringing many of the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall to their feet. Keith Lockhart conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra and the Huddersfield Choral Society. The Hallelujah Chorus has been chosen on no fewer than 41 occasions by castaways including Charles McKerris in 1975, the comedian Eric Sykes in 1997, and the historian David Starkey in 2005. Well, Desert Island Discs presenter Kirsty Young will be back on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall with more castaways in around 20 minutes. But first, it's time to join Mariella Frostrup and her guests for tonight's Proms Plus Literary event, exploring Desert Island book choices. It was recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
For a bookworm, the prospect of being stuck on a desert island with nothing but the screech of gulls and the waves lapping on the shore to distract you from your reading has much to recommend it. But once you've ploughed through your complete Shakespeare and delved deep into the Bible, what sort of choices have Desert Island Discs castaways made to pep up that literary diet? Tonight, we're going to be talking about the Desert Island book nominations over 70 years of Radio 4's iconic programme and discovering what those titles say about the castaways and the programmes themselves. To help me explore these fascinating and sometimes downright masochistic choices, from Silence of the Lambs to A Timetable of Steamers, I'm delighted to welcome the lyricist and cricket fanatic Sir Tim Rice, honoured as a castaway not once but twice, Dame Harriet Walter, an RSC stalwart and known on the small screen as D.I. Natalie Chandler in Law and Order, also a castaway, who'll be bringing some of the book choices to life, and finally, the writer Kevin Jackson, who we've cast as our literary sleuth, forensically studying the archive. Kevin, as I said, you've delved deep into the book choices over 70 years. Does anyone actually pick their favourite book?
I'm not going to suggest that anybody ever shows off on Desert Island Discs. That would be quite unthinkable in our nation. What's really seemed to emerge, I think, is that to place a good construction on it, people often choose the great big book that they haven't actually got around to reading. They think, well, I'm going to be stuck on this island for who knows how many years. It better be something big. So War and Peace is very popular. Some of the longer Dickens novels are very popular. Surprisingly popular is Gibbon, who I think very few people these days actually read for pleasure, though, in fact, if you dip into the footnotes, he's kind of fun. Overall, absolute outright winner, no question, no holds barred, is Proust.
We'll be coming to Proust in a moment, don't rush me. Okay. But Tim, you having been a castaway, not once but twice, as I pointed out, is it true that you're never trying to show off when you make your book choices, or is there a bit of a thought about how people are going to perceive the book you choose?
I don't know. I think perhaps in my case I had a bit of reverse snobbery or reverse showing off. I chose Alice in Wonderland, or actually the complete works of Lewis Carroll first time around. Alice in Wonderland was one of my favourite books as a child, and indeed it still is one of my favourite. But I wanted the complete works of Lewis Carroll because he also wrote a lot of books on mathematics and logic and calculus and all that. And I thought if you're on the desert island, you would have great fun trying to, or I would have great fun, most people probably wouldn't, trying to find how numbers worked and what they can do. And some of his puzzles and problems, I think, would have kept me happy. Second time around, I chose Molesworth, which... I do love, but it's not exactly very intellectual. I probably should have gone for Proust and impressed people. I played the game as if I were stranded. I think it's more fun doing that. And I think, I mean, Proust, I've never read a word of Proust, I'm ashamed to say.
Harriet, perhaps for Tim's benefit, you could read us a bit of Proust from À la recherche de temps perdu.
This is from The Way by Swans, Part 1, Cambrai. For a long time, I went to bed early. Sometimes, my candle scarcely out, my eyes would close so quickly that I did not have time to say to myself, I'm falling asleep. And half an hour later, the thought that it was time to try to sleep would wake me. I wanted to put down the book I thought I still had in my hands and blow out my light. I had not ceased while sleeping to form reflections on what I'd just read, but these reflections had taken a rather peculiar turn. It seemed to me that I myself was what the book was talking about. A church, a quartet, the rivalry between François I and Charles V. This belief lived on for a few seconds after my waking. It did not shock my reason, but lay heavy like scales on my eyes and kept them from realising that the candlestick was no longer lit.
What is it about that particular book, do you think? Why do people choose it?
I think it divides between those for whom it is a sort of sacred book. Proustians tend to be somewhat fanatical, and for a work which is very much about the anatomy of snobbery in many ways, I'm afraid there is a tremendous amount of snobbery attached to Proust, who, by the way, from what I've read, which is about a quarter of the whole thing, is fantastic. But, you know, it is a desert island book. I think for others it's simply that mere thing of what is the longest book I can think of? And, you know, it's very long. And I think it has that immense virtue. You think, presumably one of the things about the books, and I think people cheat when they do survival type books, you know, how to build a raft, that kind of thing. I think it's the kind of thing that makes you feel that you can live imaginatively in a completely other world. And the fact that you're there alone, and Proust's book is partly about solitude, but partly also about the experience of society, I think, you know, you would feel like you were living amongst a very rich gallery of people.
Harriet, it is a bit like writing a narrative of your life, isn't it, appearing on Desert Island Discs? Did you feel it like that? And is it hard not to try and author it as a result? You know, rock stars choosing economists, actors choosing scientists, Tracy Emin choosing Spinoza.
I couldn't be a snob about literature because, I wouldn't know where to start. I very much was torn between a book that I wanted to read that I'd heard was good but had never read, you know, like War and Peace or something, and something that I loved very much and wanted to return to for comfort. I think in one way, if I was really honest, I'd have chosen Dickens. But I didn't. I thought, I'm going to do a woman, you know, let's always promote the woman. And I also genuinely thought, you know, I'm so scared of the thought of being left alone on an island. If I chose a woman who, as I did, had been a poor little invalid in, you know, in Victorian life and had gone out and braved the world and been a fantastically adventurous traveller, she'd make me feel rather sort of okay to be alone on an island. So I said, it was rather...
Though I have to say, the passage you've chosen made me feel totally unadventurous. I mean, she really is feisty. Could you perhaps read that?
Well, she didn't start feisty. This is Isabella Bird, who was treated as an invalid most of her life and sent to Hawaii to kind of, for her health, sort of TB reasons, and then took so much to the idea of being in foreign parts that she spent the rest of her life travelling all over the world, and she was about 4 foot something. Every time she went back home to Britain, she fell ill again and lay on the sofa. So I just found her fascinating. And this is her talking about her adventures in the Rocky Mountains. I was dizzied and breathless by the pace at which we were going. A shorter time than it takes to tell, it brought us close to and abreast of the surge of cattle. The bovine waves were a grand sight. Huge bulls shaped like buffaloes bellowed and roared, and with great oxen and cows with yearling calves galloped like racers, and we galloped alongside of them and shortly headed them, and in no time were placed as sentinels across the mouth of the valley. It seemed like infantry, awaiting the shock of cavalry as we stood as still as our excited horses would allow. I almost quailed as the surge came on, but when it got close to us, my comrades hooted fearfully, and we dashed forward with the dogs, and with bellowing, roaring, and thunder of hooves, the wave receded as it came.
Well, definitely a classic and very much of its time. And the list really heavily favours classics, doesn't it, Kevin?
Very much so.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because people sort of finally think, well, I'll have the time at last to approach that great tome that I've meant to read all my life?
That's definitely true, and I think there's also the sense of the tried and tested, that nobody's particularly impressed if you've read the latest, shall we say, Shopaholic novel or something like that. But if you actually have read Gargantua and Pantagruel, people might avoid you as being a bore, but they'll be quite impressed. I did a rough estimate. I don't think there are probably more than about a dozen living writers on the list, perhaps a few more, but not many. You can see certain patterns coming out, and it's interesting kind of what gets neglected. I mean, virtually the entire 18th century, apart from Samuel Johnson, is forgotten. Pope, Swift, Burke, you name it, they're not there.
Tim, I mean, is there a sense that people want to learn something, that they want to come out of the experience having discovered something, maybe even something practical? I know Trevor Nunn picked a yoga manual, which I thought was quite a good idea, actually.
It all depends how you play the game, which applies to the music as well as the books. You can play it, just choose records and a book that have meant something to you, or you can actually choose something that you think will keep you alive and sane on the island. Sometimes the two are the same thing. I mean, I would have loved to have taken a big novel, but I thought, well, if I take the wrong one and I don't like it, I'm safer with Lewis Carroll or Molesworth. And interestingly, with people like Proust and, you know, Tolstoy, I mean, presumably it depends on which translation you get, because I would imagine Proust has been translated brilliantly and badly. So you've got to know which version to get, unless you want to try and read it in the original French, which actually would be quite interesting because that would occupy a lot of time. But then you need a French dictionary. It's
getting quite complicated, yes. Isn't it? But let's move on to someone that I presume people are choosing in translation, because otherwise the intellectuals on Desert Island Discs are even more intellectual than we ever imagined. Dante's Divine Comedy. Again, why a top choice, Kevin?
It's one of my. I have two choices. One is Molesworth, which is my pleasurable choice, and then I have Dante, which is my serious choice. And Dante, because it's a very short poem. You could actually read the damn thing in about a day. The damn thing. That was absolutely unintentional. And yet, you know, you can spend a lifetime reading it and you don't exhaust it. It's, as a friend of mine used to say, like a multi-story car park, it operates on many levels. So you can read it simply for the story, which is a damned gripping story, again, or you can read it for, you know, the various levels of sort of intellectual debate which take part in it. And it's very beautiful and very frightening.
Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. Ah me, how hard a thing it is to say what was this forest savage, rough and stern, which in the very thought renews the fear. So bitter is it, death is little more, but of the good to treat which there I found, speak will I of the other things I saw there. I did do it at Italian A level, and the sound is rather beautiful, but it refers all the time to sort of people who were prominent in 14th century Italy, who you've got to look up the footnotes for to know what they were about.
It's quite staggeringly violent at times as well, isn't it? You know, that the number of mutilations, I mean, the character Bertrand de Born, who walks around holding his own head, which he shouts out at, for example, is pretty memorable. And there's also people being disemboweled and bathing in blood, and there are rains of what I think I politely could call excrement. It's a chamber of horrors.
I think people choose it because they feel rather glad that they're slightly in a better place.
But is it the sort of book, I mean, it's a bit like Silence of the Lambs, which I know was chosen as well. Is it the sort of book that you'd want to read when you're stuck in a remote, barren place, alone? Tim?
As you reach your twilight years, I think you feel you'd rather read things that you know are good, that history or posterity has told you that's good, not posterity, what's the opposite of that? Anyway, books that you know are almost certainly going to be brilliant because they've survived, rather than take a punt on something which might be great, but, you know, I mean, I haven't got time to listen to brilliant current pop singers like Jessie J with any great detail, because I'd rather listen to the Everly Brothers again, you know, because I know they're good. I haven't got much time left to get into new people.
Come.
Although I do like Jessie J.
Are there surprising absences from the list, Kevin?
There's not much poetry. I sort of expected rather more. And what poetry does come up is fairly conventional. I was kind of surprised that more people didn't choose Philip Larkin, who I think is, you know, usually considered one of the best loved poets, if not the best poets of the last century. People who chose T.S. Eliot, who was supposedly, according to the BBC poll, our favourite poet of the 20th century, is only represented a few times by four quartets rather than by the entire body of work. And the entire body of work is only about 200 pages, so you felt they were being a bit sort of self-limiting.
I'm surprised there's so few contemporary novels as well, or novels by living authors.
It's very interesting, that point, because there's an awful lot of music is chosen by people who are still alive. Mm. And I remember when I was doing it, choosing, you know, one or two pop records, and sometimes by people I knew. One would think, I've got to have a record by this artist because they'll be terribly offended if I don't have them. They couldn't give us stuff, frankly, because they wouldn't hear the programme.
You mentioned a love of maths earlier, and composer John Rutter chose Teach Yourself Mathematics, illustrated by voluptuous women. Slightly beggar's belief.
Really?
Would that be your ideal choice, then?
Well, I haven't read that particular book.
I'm not sure he read it either.
I do like books on numbers and mathematics. I mean, I'm a bit of an anorak, really. I mean, most of my interests in life, like cricket and astronomy, have emerged from, you know, liking numbers. I do find there's a great beauty in mathematics, because mathematics exists. If man didn't exist, mathematics would. Pi would still be 3.14159, even if we weren't here.
Let's see an example, Harriet, of the sort of thing Tim would consider now to be really unputdownable.
Okay. A long minute, this one.
Tim, this is for you, all right. It follows from the definition of perfection that the sum of reciprocals of the divisors of a perfect number is 2. For example, since 28 plus 28 equals 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 7 plus 14 plus 28. We can divide through by 28 and obtain 2 equals 1 28th plus 1 14th plus 1 7th plus 1 quarter plus half plus 1.
Well, that was from the Penguin Book of Curious and Interesting Numbers by David Wells, and it was about the number 28, in case you hadn't guessed. Is it a good example, though, Kevin, of something that we should take heart from, which is the sort of human striving for betterment, as it were, that there are a lot of books on this list that are all about people wanting to achieve something, to better themselves, to use this time constructively?
I mean, I think the basic idea of the book is to say something about your own personality, really, isn't it? It's a book that's meant a lot to you, or a book that says something about what you basically are in your imagination. But a lot of people are self-improvers, and I think that's a very good thing.
And if it is about showing your personality, what does it say about you two gentlemen, both of whom would have chosen Molesworth? I'll give you first voice on this, Tim.
Well, I suppose in my case, Molesworth, again, was something from my childhood. And I think, again, the older you get, the more you look back on things that you loved in your childhood, because you were certain that you loved them when you were a kid. And then you grow up, and you're not certain that you really love the things you think you do. But when you get, you know, a little bit older, you think, hang on, I know I love that. I know I loved astronomy. I know I love the planet Saturn. I know I love Nigel Molesworth. And also, as it happens, Molesworth is a brilliant book. He's a great philosopher, Nigel Molesworth. He's up there with, you know, Popper and Wittgenstein. He really has a great view on life in the 50s for a young person. And it's very funny, very witty.
There are also, actually, Kevin, I mean, I want to know why you chose Molesworth as well, but there's also very few funny books on the list. And actually, one of the things you'd think there'd be a dearth of on the island would be laughter, because it's quite hard to make yourself laugh.
There are a few books. I mean, there are things which, Three Men in a Boat was, I think, chosen by Vic Reeves. A very charming book, which, you know, has that quality of idyll and paradise about it as well. Wind in the Willows is not exactly a funny book, although it does have very nice humorous passages. That's quite popular.
It's more whimsical, isn't it?
Yeah, some Dickens novels. Obviously, there's a lot of wonderful humor in Dickens, like we were talking earlier about the passage in Great Expectations where Mr. Wopsle plays Hamlet, which has made me cry with laughter.
Winnie the Pooh?
Winnie the Pooh, yes.
Bit of Woodhouse,
if you like that kind
there,
of... Woodhouse is quite popular.
Yeah.
It's quite popular. But books that make you laugh out loud, I think, are rare and to be treasured. And Molesworth, for me, not only do you have the fantastically timed prose of Geoffrey Willans, a great genius of prose writing by anybody's standards, but you have the magnificent cartoons of Ronald Searle, which are, so you have two for the price of one. You get brilliant prose and brilliant sketches. So I think it's a cheat, but it's very, very rich.
Well, we can't bring you Searle's drawings on radio, sadly, but we can bring you a passage from Molesworth. Harriet, if you would.
We can't bring you the spelling either, but I shall enjoy that while I read it. Visiting the school. The day the parents come means much activity at the school. All rude drawings and propaganda, down with the mallmongers, meeting at Dalston Friday, are wiped off blackboards. School dog is muzzled, boys wash their necks, and the bath is cleaned. Next, masters are let out of their cells in new suits, mashers, ties, etc., and are forced by the headmaster to toe party line. Have you been guilty of imperialist dogma in break by pinching a boy's cup of cocoa? I have. Have you practiced sabotage against the school piano by cutting wires so that low C sounds plunk? I have. Do you admit this led to subversive singing of Jiken John Plunk in his Plunk So Gay? I do. Do you further admit to placing 3 tin ashtrays on the top of the said piano? I do. So that class sing Jia Tinkle Plunk John Plunk Tinkle in his Tinkle Tinkle Zing? They did. Were you also a tool of Wall Street by interfering with the metronome while music mistress was singing Trees at the school concert? I was. Did you express the view that even if the music mistress was a tree, you would not like her planted in your garden? Yes. Who invented the first railway engine? Stalin.
One of the things that's wonderful about that, and partly it's just the beautiful comic timing of it, I think, a wonderful placing of words, and the spelling, of course, is a joy in its own right. But of course, at one level, it's actually a satire, you know, not only of a minor public school, but it's about the Moscow show trials. You know, it's all this stuff about Stalin and the steam engine, show trials, the stuff about CND, down with the warmongers, meeting doors on Friday. It's, the jokes are very much about the grown-up world as well as the child world.
Are you sure you're not just trying to add hidden depth to our image of you,
Kevin? I have to say that there is, of course, although Tim has unfairly described Nigel as no intellectual, there's a very good chapter about Proust.
A great philosopher,
but before then the books aren't terribly intellectual. There's a wonderful chapter about Proust, do you remember, where Nigel pretends to the headmaster Grimes that he's been reading Swan's Way, which finally ends with Grimes saying, "Silence, boy, there is no such book."
Yes. This is in danger of turning into the Molesworth fan club. Thank you all very much indeed. I'm afraid that's where our time runs out. Thanks very much to our guests, Tim Rice, Kevin Jackson, and Harriet Walter, and all the past castaways whose book choices we've been scrutinising. Enjoy the rest of tonight's prom.
Mariella Frostrup presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Allegra McElroy. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and part two of this particularly unusual prom, marking 7 decades of the Radio 4 programme Desert Island Discs. So far, we've heard the musical choices of castaways, including Sir David Attenborough and Darcy Bustle. The BBC Concert Orchestra is providing the music, sometimes on their own, sometimes accompanying the Huddersfield Choral Society, or distinguished soloists, some of whom have been castaways themselves. Kirsty Young will be meeting plenty more castaways between now and the end of the concert. And the Desert Island Discs team is hosting a live blog where you can share your Desert Island choices and talk about the prom as it happens. You can find the blog by visiting the Radio 4 homepage or visit the prom's homepage at bbc.co.uk/proms and follow the links. And that applause is for Principal Conductor Keith Lockhart returning to the platform to start the second half of the prom with another theme I think you'll recognise.
Well, Simon West Nobby, I do feel as if we should have jogged on to that, but I can't quite manage it in these heels. Welcome to Desert Island Discs at the Proms. It is wonderful to have you here, Falklands war veteran and a very well-known man, clearly, in this auditorium. Last week, you marked the Cardiff Festival by lighting the Olympic torch for the Paralympics. Now, that must have been a pretty special moment.
It was immense. It was something that not many people are going to get a chance to do, not in this country. There's only 4 to do it in the evening like that. But it was an immensely proud moment for me. I have a huge respect for Paralympians. You know, they've overcome nature and man-made adversity, and they go on to achieve so brilliantly, and we watch them now and see how they achieve. They're just so inspirational.
You yourself... You yourself have faced a good deal of man-made adversity, to use your phrase. It was on the Sir Galahad in 1982 that you met with great trauma and horror. I'm wondering, coming onto a program like Desert Island Discs, where you talk on the public stage about something that is incredibly intimate and personal, why did you make a decision to do that, and what effect did it have?
Sometimes you can live with your own ghosts for far too long. And it's nice to be able to get it out. And other people then understand. You know, people see you and they see you on TV, but they only get to see a short clip. And sometimes it's nice just to express yourself in your own words, and so that other people understand exactly who you are and what you've been through. But not just you, because you're almost, to take the earlier part of the conversation, you're almost a torchbearer for those who served with you and those who didn't come home. You know, so it's important. And I think it's important that people don't forget the sacrifice and the service that so many make, and all those ones who don't come home, and the families that are bereaved, you know, that they are remembered as well.
I should mention to people we came on there to Barry Stoller's Offside, which was one of the pieces that you chose from Match of the Day, of course. We're going to hear one of your other choices a little later on. But for now, Simon, a great inspiration to so many people, very clear from the applause. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Well, our next castaway tonight was once voted the nation's favourite actress. She is Patricia Routledge. Patricia, can I welcome you, please, on stage? Thank you for coming. So many endless cheers. We are spoiling you tonight. I hope you appreciate this. Patricia, you've been cast away twice on Desert Island Discs, and on both occasions, I understand you took, was it tea-making facilities and a selection of teas?
Yes, indeed.
Tell me about that.
Yes. Two china cups and saucers, a silver tea set, and every known kind of tea and tisane. Two cups and saucers for when somebody flies in to collect me. And I shall serve it in a large picture hat, a floral dress, and gloves. Because, of course, appearances have to be kept up.
I should just check. Was there builder's tea in there as well, just in case you wanted?
No, at my address.
I thought not. Now, you're a lover not just of tea, but of poetry too. You've taken with you various an anthology of poetry and the collected works of
yes.
John Donne.
Yes.
It's pianistic poetry, really, that we're going to hear tonight as one of your choices. Just explain a little bit about what we're going to hear and why you chose it for discs.
It's a glorious piece. I love the piano. Beethoven loved the piano, and with this gloriously affirmative generosity of music, it would take me through any kind of lows or highs.
Patricia Routledge, CBE, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Thank you. Well, I should tell you that the soloist who is about to join the BBC Concert Orchestra also chose the piece he's about to play when he was cast away. That was in 1988. It is Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, and here to play the first movement with the BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart is Peter Donohoe.
Thank you. Thank you.